We kick off the second hour, as always on Tuesday, by welcoming into the program our friend, writer Colin Fleming. You can pre-order his latest book. It's part of the 33 and a Third series and entitled Sam Cooke, Live at the Harvard Square Club, 1963. Hello there, Colin.
Harlem, not Harvard. Harlem.
Did I say Harvard?
You did.
I did.
You want to go, Kimball?
Harvard Square. I was thinking of you being close to Harvard Square.
Yeah, I like to avoid Cambridge. But speaking of education, I've been working on your brand. I've been working hard for you on your
Thank
behalf.
You.
You know how Johnny Dollar, right? You and Dollar both have a pecuniary type name. He's Dollar, you're Rich Guy Kimball.
True.
The man with the action-packed expense account.
Yes.
You can be the man with the action-packed lesson plan.
Well, I like that.
Right?
I like that, yeah.
You're back in business. You solve the problems of the kids. You lurk outside their homes. You're there for them when they come out with advice. I like that. I think it could work.
I'm going to follow that, see how it goes. The lurking outside their homes might that might cause some issues, but you know, I've been around for a while. I've got that going for me.
The bottom line is results.
That's it. Yeah. Name of the game. Right.
You help the kids. You say that to some mom. Say, look, sure, I'm out here in your bushes, but look how much better your boy is doing.
Right.
Do you think that's the result, though?
He understands the Constitution so much better now. I hope you appreciate my efforts, Mrs. Johnson.
I think it's strange that people are back in school. You're back, right, in August. It just doesn't seem right to me.
Our first students come back on Friday. I'm actually going in to try to do some work in my classroom tonight, which is a mess. We had some renovations. Beautiful new classroom, but I've got to put everything back together. I just texted a friend who's there working, and I said, what's the temperature like in our end of the building? And he said, Vietnam hot.
Yeah, it was a little warm.
I'm going to look like you after 5,000 steps.
Oh, I don't know. I think I have a problem. I think I might actually, I've been looking this up on like WebMD, if I have some sort of, I'm worried it's indicative of like diabetes or something, because I have a lot of, I was actually sitting there today after running some of my stairs, and my puddles make puddles. It like ricochets and flies past my ankle, and I don't think it's a normal amount of perspiration. I really don't.
I'm not a doctor. I've played one on stage, but I'm not sure I can offer good advice here.
Kimball, but it's fine. I just 31 days, maybe 2 days in a row with at least 3,000 stairs. So how diabetic can I be realistically,
yeah,
right?
Right. And you've been eating right, so of course, you're fine.
I don't know if I eat right. I don't drink. I think that was the big thing I noticed about how much weight I just lost right away. It was the drinking. That I had never really realized. I mean, I did on some level, but I didn't really realize how much drinking adds weight-wise, the sugars or whatever it is. But I think that's where like the bulk of my calories was coming from.
But that's why you look so youthful, because you don't drink, you don't smoke.
I did smoke for a while. I actually smoked for 5 years. You want to know when the last cigarette I had was, Kimball?
Well, of course I do.
This is horrific, but it steered me straight. It was the day I watched my father die in front of me.
Ugh.
I said, that's going to be enough for the sea dog with the old cigarettes. And it wasn't because he was a smoker or anything like that. It wasn't like I connected it that way. It was just like, well, this is not... This can't be good. But I smoked for 5 years, and then one day I did the same way with the drinking. I just stopped cold turkey.
Wow. Well, listen, you're a strong man. You're a Zulu warrior to the nth degree. We've already established this.
I am. It's my Portuguese blood. I'm a Portuguese, actually, Kimball. Don't be thrown by my name. I come from the streets of New Bedford, not far from the Whaling Museum.
Oh.
I am a Portuguese, so that has something to do with it.
Know that area very well. Well, lots to talk about, as always, here this afternoon. And let's begin with a recent piece you did for Jazz Times on John Coltrane. And when people talk about his greatest, they often talk about A Love Supreme. As you say, nothing against A Love Supreme. It's amazing. But maybe people ought to take another listen to Ascension and, as you say, work of art. Why?
I find it tiresome. You're right. People do automatically knee-jerk reaction. They say Love Supreme with Coltrane. They say Kind of Blue with Miles Davis. And it's just so limiting to fall into the trappings of critical canon, because I don't think they're revisited all that often. I think it's just something that people say and then they repeat, and we're intellectually lazy. And so the old saw lives on. And Love Supreme was very much a paean to, call it what you will, God, a higher consciousness, the questing, overriding spirit of the artist, something transcendent, whereas Ascension, and that earlier record, Love Supreme, that was the classic quartet. Ascension adds more musicians, and it is the paint peeler of jazz albums. At least it was until that point. It is the loudest jazz that had ever been recorded up until then, some of the most challenging jazz. I think it's highly melodic, actually, but it's highly melodic within this beehive of this controlled cacophony of sound. And you have someone like Elvin Jones, who the drummer, who'd been along for the ride for a while with Coltrane. He is just losing his bleep in the studio over how technically demanding and uncompromising this music was. He throws his snare drum against the wall. But you have Freddie Hubbard on trumpet, who is playing at the level of Train himself during this particular date. And I think Freddie Hubbard is one of the overlooked trumpet titans. He's someone who should be mentioned in the same breath with a Dizzy Gillespie. I think he's actually better than Dizzy Gillespie, or Louis Armstrong. And so this is really a date that shows off his tour de force type of skills.
You also say in your Jazz Times piece that Coltrane's best work has the feel that it's unfolding in real time. Can you explain that?
Coltrane, I actually saw a quote of his today where he said something like, seriousness can be fun. You don't have to just joke your life away. And I would say, really, the only knock I have on Coltrane, even when he failed interestingly. The one knock I would have on him is that there's not a lot of humor anywhere in his oeuvre. Like, you just don't, I don't know that you can be the best of the best of the best if you're not encapsulating everything. But there's a freshness, there's an immediacy of the moment to his material where you feel like it didn't pre-exist. You feel like you've come upon something that is in the midst of its own happening. I think that's the authentic voice that you're going for in any type of art you create. That's what separates, one of the things that separates the degrees of art. I know somebody who thinks like once you reach a certain like level of creation, you're on the shelf with whether it's the Great Gatsby is next to Moby Dick or whatnot, speaking of New Bedford. But I don't think that's true. I think you can parse it even further. And that immediacy to me, that lack of a pre-existing feel, like it just wasn't something that was ramped up to. It's something that was and is and that you've happened upon and you can re-happen upon it is what defines Coltrane's music, and certainly this particular record, which is an absolute barn burner to listen to. I mean, what is it? Heavy metal jazz? What category is this even in? There's no category for this.
Do you think those who don't perhaps put it at that high level are intimidated by the sheer volume?
Yeah, that's an interesting question, because it sounds cool. Like whenever you mention volume to people in music, conversationally, it sounds cool. It sounds cool when I say it. I remember I wrote this op-ed too about the Beatles' Help, and I said it was their loudest track to date. It's like something you say. It might be true. I don't know, but it sounds cool to people. It's like they want to check that out. So in theory, they like that idea. You can score a lot of brownie points with people. It's like, ooh, volume, wow, it's loud as the who, decibels, all of that stuff. I think it was more how corrosive the music was, that it flirted with the atonal. And atonal music is music that doesn't have a key. And to some people, it can sound horribly disorganized. But this was meticulously organized, even though it was extemporized, which sounds like a contradiction in terms, but you have to think quickly to execute music like this, because it's that idea of controlled improvisation. But it makes a lot of sense to me, because I might go into writing a story, say, with a plan, but I'm going to let what happens happen and adjust on the fly. I think life is that way, and the best art that reflects life the best way is also that way.
Read more of Colin's thoughts on Coltrane's ascension at Jazz Times. From there to one of the more interesting and unusual sci-fi films of the 1950s from Universal International, The Monolith Monsters.
Yeah, did the I wonder if the title of this particular film steers people away, because it's like a monolith. It's like, ooh, a vocab word. But it's really one of the, because think of how garish titles could be at the time. Like, you were almost trying to like out sensationalize your competitor with the attack of the 50,000 foot, whatever it was going to be, type of film of the 1950s. And this is really a well-made, maybe not the best acted, but a really well-made, effective, earnest film that tries to be a good film. And I think largely pulls it off. There are elements of an H.P. Lovecraft story from 1927 called The Color Out of Space. And it's in his fictional world of Arkham, which is like Salem, Massachusetts, that Ipswich type of area. And this poisoning of the earth. Something falls from space and it makes the animals go insane. It makes people go insane. There are huge vegetables that you can't eat, but they just grow super large. And so you have a meteor in this film, and it also, too, corrupts the land. It's a story about monster crystals, which also don't seem to themselves have this embedded menace. It's not like aliens, like, we're going to get you stupid earthlings, morons, up to no good. It doesn't have that. In fact, it's like an ecological parable in some ways. And it works so well because it's like the earth, in a sense, rebelling against itself and its inhabitants.
I love the cast in this, too. Grant Williams, who was in one of my favorite science fiction films, The Incredible Shrinking Man. Lola Albright, who I will always love for her role on Peter Gunn. And then Les Tremaine, who was one of the great radio guys of all time.
Yeah, I mean, it's like some of the lines are a little clunky, but the performances are, well, I'd say they're winsome. I'd say everyone's really bought in to this particular film that they were doing. And it holds up really well. I would say, I mean, we all know like the super famous 1950s sci-fi / horror films, because the genres, they blurred. I think that's really interesting. But Day of the Earth Stood Still in 51, and of course Invasion of the Body Snatchers, and Them, and The Thing, and Creature from the Black Lagoon. But this is like a solid sort of like lesser all-star, like a Scott Cooper that makes the team like once. And it's really pretty rewatchable. I watched it again this week just to see how it held up from the last time I had seen it. And it works. It really is well done. And like, you actually root for these people. You pull for these people. You want solutions. The newspaper editor in this tank town, quite self-deprecating, and the crystals, the special effects, a lot of it's like using two pieces of film at once, but I still find it pretty convincing the way they fall over and they just rise up through the enemy of the film. I guess the villain in some ways is water.
And you mentioned H.P. Lovecraft. Let's dovetail into him a little bit.
Lovecraft was someone who could be uneven, I'd say. There is like a huge disparity between Lovecraft at his best and, like, well, frankly, a lot of Lovecraft, like 90% of the rest of it. He was so enthralled to like the sound of his own voice in writing. If there was like a 17 syllable word, it was always better to replace it with a 19 syllable word if you had it. And that was just sort of taking away, I'd say, from a lot of the thrust or the would-be thrust of his stories. But The Color Out of Space is his bell cow, closest version to perfection in fiction form. He's actually a really good nonfiction writer. If you read his, he wrote a kind of guidebook to the supernatural fiction he had read, which is quite effective. And his letters, which of course were voluminous, are fascinating. Now, whenever Lovecraft comes up, it's like the Lovecraft county, country, whatever that show is called. And then it's also that you have to say he's bad and he's racist, because you just have to say that everybody is bad and racist who doesn't live anymore. But if you want to read the one sort of go-to Lovecraft story, I would say that it's The Color Out of Space. And he built this fictional world. Like, it's really just clearly Salem and, like, Cape Ann and the North Shore of Massachusetts. But if you're into, like, really bad things happening and ghosts and monsters and ancient societies of the dead coming back in coastal New England, and if you're in Maine, I'm assuming you live there for a reason, he's got stuff in Maine, then he's going to be a guy you're going to want to check out. And you get a complete edition of his books. I have one right here in my bathroom. I'm touching it right now for, like, pretty cheap. Not his letters, of course. That'll take you a lot of books. But you can get all his fiction in one place between two hardcovers.
From there, let's move from Lovecraft to M.R. James, who we've talked about many times before, but a particularly interesting reading of his work, The Mezzotint, by Michael Hordern. And I love Michael's voice and his accent. He's awesome.
Yes, Michael Hordern is, of course, my guy, because I have my book on 1951, Scrooge, coming out in December after the Sam Cooke book, and he is Jacob Marley in that film, and he is the Jacob Marley of all Jacob Marleys. And you think, like, when he's in the film, it's like Jacob Marley should be old, but Michael Hordern, he went on for a long time after 1951, Scrooge, and he did a lot of reading. There are like 20 of them. Of M.R. James stories. And The Mezzotint is one of the first ghost story efforts that M.R. James did. And it has one of those ideas that just seems so appealing, where you always get these, like, collectors, usually they're book collectors in M.R. James stories. But this guy has a mezzotint. It's like an engraving. It's like having a painting in your room. And he notices something not just going on in his mezzotint, but each time, like, he comes back, something has changed in it. And so we're reading this story looking in on this guy looking in, who sometimes, like, brings his friends around to look in on this drama within a drama. And that's just such an appealing idea for a story. Now, I would say the knock on this story, we're going to have a knock on Coltrane, probably should have a knock on this, is that there's no real jeopardy for the guy who is telling the story. He's just, like, observing it. And so I feel like when you write a story, when you have a story, and even if it looks like it's about someone else, you're telling a story about somebody else, and you're this guy, this is what he did, this is what he was like, ultimately, in some ways, it has to fundamentally, I think, be about you. There has to be some either physical jeopardy or, more consequently, emotional jeopardy. And really, there's just more of a notion of curiosity for this guy as this mezzotint continues to change. And then at the end, this is one of the things with, like, ghost stories that's tricky. Ghost stories generally suffer from a couple things. One of them is that they don't have a lot of utility. They're just sort of atmosphere, and they play the spine like a zither, but they don't really have legs out into the world, which is what I endeavor to do with my own ghost story-based writings. And then they're difficult, usually, for people to conclude. At the end, you get someone saying, well, let me walk you through what might have happened here. And it gets a little clunky, like at the end of Psycho, almost, although that's not a ghost story, of course. But, yeah, definitely an M.R. James story. And this reading, if you don't want to actually use your eyeballs, will help you out.
And we'll finish up today with a discussion of the Grateful Dead's Dark Star. Let me preface this by saying, and I've given you credit, you've changed my approach to the Grateful Dead. I've been listening to them a whole lot more in recent weeks after our conversations, but I'm convinced you sent me to this one because of our prior discussion about live performances involving the Rolling Stones. So the Dead took a song that was 2 minutes and 40 seconds in the studio version and stretched it out to 23. But I found I enjoyed this one. Why? Why did I enjoy this more than other live recordings?
Time marches on, Kimball, and you're evolving. I'm working on what I feel like are the weak spots of your education.
Oh, thank you.
And
thank
things, you. I take care of things when I feel you're ready. The progression. You know how it is with the students.
Right.
It's not how you perform on the first day when those kids come in. It's how they leave your classroom ready to go out, go forth into the world as Kimballians.
Right. You're meeting me where I am and taking me to this brave new place.
Well, we probably would have gotten to it eventually within this now. It's the fifth time we've talked about the dead this year alone. And also, you had mentioned your father-in-law in jazz. And I just was sitting there thinking the other day, thinking, what does Kimball think jazz is? Like, jazz, of all things, is extemporized and that quick thinking. And you might have what's called a head chart, which is just like sort of vague indications of what we're going to do. But you find the sound as you're making the sound. And really, this is a key point. That is so much creation. No matter how much you plan, you have to be able to adapt as you're making it. Because a character is going to say to you, that wasn't what I did in that particular spot. You thought I was going to go there, but this is what I actually did. Like, oh, thank you. I've listened to you. I'll put that down now, the way you actually lived your story. So I would say with this infamous, famous, legendary performance piece of Dark Star by the Dead, that, and I just listened to it actually right before you called. I listened to the entire thing. There isn't really a wasted note. It's organic. It's dialogic. It's one person on an instrument says this, and then we go off in that particular direction. And then maybe somebody wants to steer it back this way. And it ebbs and it flows, and it has certain crescendos that really move you. They impel you. They get you excited. And it's like, okay, don't get overexcited. We'll cool it down a bit. And then it builds to something that you're now more ready for. And I thought, like, when I get to the end of it, people will say sometimes that, oh, I was reading this and I didn't want it to end. And they think they're giving you a compliment. And they probably mean it that way. And to them, it is a compliment. And they're meaning something than what they actually literally mean with those words. But I always think, like, that's not what you're going for. You want it to end exactly where it's supposed to end. And so get to the end of this song, this nearly half-hour performance with this 13-minute, whatever it is, Jerry Garcia guitar solo, which is like Hendrix exciting. He shreds at certain points. He's Charlie Christian at other points. And he's not just doing it to show off. He's interweaving with these other guys. And it ends exactly where it should end. Like, this is, of course, the one I picked out was one of the versions that Dead people esteem as like the grail. So it's like top three, top five, whatever it is. But I actually thought you would like this.
Well, and what I like about it, and you touched on it, is that it's not just, okay, solo time, and you know, while you're playing guitar, yeah, I'm going to be out back having a smoke or a drink or whatever. These solos, they built on what had come before, and they lead naturally into what will follow. And while it's individual band members playing, it still feels like the unit as a whole working and creating.
I guess that's why I was a little bit surprised with the Stones piece, because they're aren't really solos in that version of Midnight Rambler. It's very much the ensemble wave. And I think, like, if you wanted to give an alien from a Lovecraftian world an idea of what's happening with the Stones, you'd find the best version of that wave to present them with. That's really their case. In some ways, Charlie Watts dying today, of the best, not that they were, but they're close, the best rock and roll band, is you need to have that ensemble wave, because no one could get that tsunami going. And that's what that song, that performance from Leeds exemplifies, like the Stones could. But this Dead track that, again, it sounds intimidating to people. It's like a half hour. It's longer than watching whatever you're going to watch an episode on the Netflix. But it doesn't feel like you're sitting there for a half hour. In other words, like, you think with the Dead, oh, noodling, there will be noodling. There's only focused progression with this particular song. So it's not like a huge leap in some ways from Ascension with Coltrane to this Dead performance. Although ironically, Coltrane is so much louder, well, for most of what he's doing, than the rock and roll band.
You mentioned Charlie Watts, who passed away at 80. He doesn't get the attention or the recognition of the Keith Moons of the world, the Neil Peart and others. But man, as far as being the guy, being the beat, being the heart and soul of a band, he's about as steady as they come in rock history.
Yes, he was. And he came from a jazz background. And so I think that was crucial, especially to the early Rolling Stones. They had these influences within their ranks. Like Brian Jones was this blues obsessive, and Chuck Berry was this, or rather Keith Richards was this Chuck Berry obsessive. And Charlie Watts was a bit of class. He was more of an Elvin Jones type of guy. He was more of a jazz-based guy. We see the same thing with Ginger Baker from Cream, coming from that jazz background. And certainly there are jazz-infused songs in the Stones catalog, but he would play in a way that I wrote an op-ed that I wasn't able to sell. I put it up in the blog. But you think about the riff, for instance, and Satisfaction. It's a huge riff, like the size of a mountain range. It sounds like a horn rather than a guitar. But what is like the central kind of tonal center of that song? It's that drum beat. Because that drum beat in that song is such a powerful presence that everything will drop out. You can hear it in your head, as I mentioned. It conjures it up. It's just that drum beat doing its thing. And it's like so simple. The Beatles will do a version of it later on with the long medley, Ringo Starr, or the end on Abbey Road. But sometimes with the Stones, you just needed the drums to give you the portent of everything else. And you knew they were about to just crank it up, go to a different level. So yes, very much a standout drummer's drummer, but more than a drummer's drummer. He had chops. Something like Get Off My Cloud. I mean, the riff of the song is the drum riff. That wasn't something that really was done. The Zombie, She's Not There, has a drum riff, but it was pretty uncommon.
And the best dressed man in rock and roll.
Yeah, and they trotted him out for that cover of Get Your Yeah Yeahs Out. And don't forget, if you like listening to Get Your Yeah Yeahs Out, at one point, Jagger makes a joke. He says, Charlie's really on tonight. It's not like he's mocking him. He is really on in that particular night. And I think, like, if you were in the Stones, you knew what an advantage that gave you, that you were going to be able to wow them at Madison Square Garden in the fall of 1969 when you had Charlie Watts playing at that level. I guess this was quite a surprise to me today because it really did sound like he had a minor health issue that was on the mend, and he just simply couldn't make this particular tour. And then, boom, he was gone. It's almost kind of like the Jimmy Hayes news from yesterday. That's just not something you see coming. And 80 seems, I don't know, it's 80 seems young, especially these days.
Absolutely. Colin Fleming, again, pre-order the new book, Sam Cooke, live at the Harlem Square Club, 1963. Got it right that time. Visit the blog, Many Moments More, the website at ColinFlemingLit.com. Thank you, as always, my friend. We'll do it again next week.
All right, sounds good.
Colin Fleming on Downtown.